borderland and the world lost a unique explorer and chronicler of the Southwest on August 30th of this year. Charles Bowden was an admired journalist and writer who often exposed the darker side of the border to a probing light. I'm Charles Horak, and you're listening to On Film. Charles Bowden's exploration of the roots and impacts of the violence in Juarez were documented in a number of his best-known books with his unique, hard-edged, and darkly poetic wordsmithing. In his 2010 book, Murder City, he wrote, "There are some things that, if learned, change a person forever." He continued, "You cannot listen to a hired killer who functioned for years as a state policeman tell of kidnappings, tortures, and murders and remain the same person." Charles Bowden branched out into filmmaking when he orchestrated an on-camera interview with a masked former Juarez hitman in the 2011 film El Sicario, Room 164. I spoke with Bowden in October of 2011 about the film and the situation in Juarez. We remember him today with a re-airing of that interview. This film, I have to say, I watched it a couple nights ago, and it's perhaps the most disturbing thing I've seen in the last year, and it's still a bit hard for me to articulate how I feel about this film. It's strangely engaging and repulsive at the same time. Who is the Sicario?
Okay, well, the guy in the film is not an actor. He's a professional killer. He's a native of Juarez. He was a state police commander in the Chihuahuan State Police for about 20 years. He was put through the police academy by the Juarez Drug Organization. For 20 years, he was a contract killer for them, and he killed hundreds of people. But I think the reason the film's disturbing to you and to me is he's a highly intelligent person, and in the, you have this terrible feeling by the end of the film that you kind of like him, even though a part of you thinks he is a monster.
Right, there is something alluring about this character, which I might add, we never get to see. We only see his hands because his face is covered.
Yeah, or a veil, and he draws a lot. No, it's a very odd film. It's the guy talks, but what he's talking about is something that's not normally said. I know of no other case of a man with his background coming forward and speaking. And what he does during the film is teach you how power works in Mexico. And it works very simply. The society is corrupt, and power is used to kill, torture, and rob the Mexican people.
And like you said, the disturbing part about it is the pattern, the way he speaks. There's an almost gentleness to his hands and his speech pattern, and that just sort of sucks you in. And you don't completely forget, but at times, as you say, you begin to sympathize with this person who's done atrocious things in his life.
He told me something once I've never forgotten. He's now a born-again Christian.
Mm-hmm.
He converted in an evangelical sense to Christ. And he told me he's been reading the Bible, and in the Bible it says all your sins can be forgiven, and that he believes the Bible absolutely, except that he doesn't think it's possible for him to ever be forgiven because of the things he's done to other people. We have to tell your listeners here that, look, this is a guy who boiled people alive. We're not just talking about a bullet through the skull.
Right.
This guy was a king of torture. It's not something I like to think about.
Do you ever find yourself questioning the veracity of what he's saying?
Yes. I went to great lengths. I sought out, I can't give you the details, obviously. I sought out one of the guys who trained him in the organization to verify he was what he said he was. I also knew his patron, that one of the reasons he spoke to me was he had somebody above him who told him to speak to me. And so, to the best of my knowledge, everything he said is true. The final thing is, we did some research into some minor things that aren't even in the film to see if we could verify them. And every time we could find any record, it was exactly as he said. So that's the best I can tell you, that he is what he says he is. The other thing is, I think if you watch the film, he's not a very boastful person. He's not claiming to be a big shot or something.
He's proud of the professionalism with which he did his job. That comes through definitely in his speech.
I agree. That's his eerie little moments of egotism. And what it is pride. It's the same kind of reaction or statement you'd get from a cabinet maker or a skilled craftsman. He's terribly resentful of amateur murders that he reads in the newspapers now.
Right.
And, yeah, it sort of stands out in the film, like you suddenly snap alert, like, what did he say?
I got lulled into the sense that he's part of this ancient tradition, and he senses that, and that somehow some of that craft, if you want to call it that, has been lost on the murderers that work in Juarez now.
Oh, I think that's a very fair statement. I mean, basically, here was a guy getting from 5,000 to 20,000 a killing when he was working. And now, you know, for $50, you can get me blown away in Juarez. It is an amateur hour. He's like a ninja from an earlier era, and he knows it.
The things he says he did personally are extremely disturbing and chilling, but also what's disturbing and chilling is his broader story of how he was groomed. He was trained at the police academy. He was apparently trained in America at the FBI academy for part of that time. He moves with ease back and forth across the border, sometimes with kidnapped victims, sometimes with drugs, sometimes with guns. He makes the point in the film that for the narcos, the cartels, there are no borders.
He's explicit. Well, he explicitly says that the U.S. government's been penetrated. He makes it quite clear that organizations like DEA and FBI, people like himself, had access to them. They knew what was going on in them. They had their people in them. That's one of the things he hammered in my head, you know. Like any intelligent person, he considered me a naive fool. Mm. So he was quite explicit in that. And frankly, I believe him after spending a lot of time with him. He's not a man who brags about much of anything except what we touched on earlier, a pride in craft.
You mentioned in the article that brought this film to life, which was in Harper's Magazine that you wrote a couple of years ago, that this was the person that you'd been seeking for 20 years. You'd been waiting for this moment to interview this person, meaning that you'd been waiting to get someone so on the inside that was willing to actually speak about these things?
I'll give you an example. In the early 90s, I was at a wedding in southern Sonora, right, almost on the Sinaloa border. And there were 200 or 300 people there, and they were all armed. Many of them were federal police, and they were all narcos. They're all in the drug world. And some of them were killers. In fact, a guy came to kill me and was stopped by the groom who insisted I was his historian. And now, don't kill my writer. But none of those people would have ever spoken to me on the record about what they were doing. This guy did. Now, the reason he did was he's a dead man walking. He's now a fugitive. There's a contract on his life of hundreds of thousands of dollars. He knows the people looking for him are just as good as he was when he was a killer. And he knows he's going to be murdered. And so he spoke. But once he started speaking, in a sense, he couldn't stop. He told me when it was all over, now I've made you dirty. And what he meant was he'd taken this poison that was in him and poured it into me. Now he felt better. He'd gotten it off his chest. And now I was toxic. And he was right.
You know, it's fascinating watching the film and this. Basically, it's a static camera. It's in a hotel room. There's a camera on a tripod pointing at this guy who's veiled, as you say, and all you can see are his hands. He's sketching little doodles and drawings and diagrams as he illustrates some of the points he's making in a pad of paper. But because of the veil, because of the way he speaks, because of the unbrokenness of that monologue, you do get the sense that this is a confessional in some regards.
It is, and it was unplanned. And I'll tell you exactly how. I went to him. I wanted 5 to 7 minutes of film for a larger project. And I asked him if he would do that. And we set various conditions, and he agreed. And then he got inside that veil. And, of course, there was hardly anyone there. You can't bring a film crew to interview a contract killer. And he got inside that veil, and something happened. It's like he was in a confessional, like in a Catholic church.
Right.
And he started talking in this intimacy like he was talking to himself. And he went on for days. 3 times during the filming, he broke down sobbing, and we had to hold him. Now, I don't think any of this would have happened if he'd just been sitting there without a veil talking. I don't think he saw it coming. but I don't think he'll ever go through it again. It was a wrenching experience for everyone involved.
One of the most compelling things I think about this film and this man's story is that his story, as intimate as it is, as personal as it is, it touches on so many of the macro problems facing Mexico, the corruption, the infiltrated government, police forces, armies, the lack of value of human life, you know, the desperation over there. That
let's not forget the word poverty.
Poverty, yes.
He was one of 12 or 13 children. He was raised in total poverty. But I've often thought, is this a very intelligent person? If he'd been born 10 miles north, he'd probably be a professional in El Paso.
But the arc of his story, his life story, particularly coming to conclusion towards the end, as you've mentioned, with this conversion experience he has, which I gather was in some sort of Mexican evangelical revival-type setting, this incredibly spiritual moment in his life, this catharsis, and the contrast of that with the ugliness of the stories he's just told. I wonder if there's any, if you felt like maybe his story in a broader sense shows some light for the broader society, that there is the potential for a spiritual catharsis in the country, and maybe that's the only way out of this cycle?
I don't know, but I know he thinks that. I know after he realized he wasn't going to give us 5 or 7 minutes of film, but he was going to exploit us like a podium he suddenly had, a pulpit. But what he wanted this film to do was tell other people they could escape. And he didn't just mean escape from the country of Mexico, escape from the shackles of poverty, corruption, and murder and violence. He wanted his life not to be wasted and to prove that there is hope, light at the end of the tunnel. Because frankly, what he thinks is anybody's as vicious as he is and has led a life as worthless as he has and can possibly redeem themselves, then anyone can.
So it's a testimonial in the end, not just a confession.
Yeah, it is. And frankly, I believe it. Look, I'm not a religious person. But his conversion, I believe, and I believe it because it didn't help his life at all. It made him almost certain to be murdered. Because once he became this born-again Christian, he lost his ability to kill people, which means people are looking to kill him, and he's defenseless. So it's not a good career move in that sense. So I think he's absolutely sincere. And I think, you know, people have to watch the film and make their own judgment.
He's certainly in a position of danger, as you mentioned, from the contract on him, and I'm sure this film doesn't help his case at all. Was there any moment where you were concerned that you and those making the film might have concerns over your own safety?
No. I'm sort of mission-focused. I just wanted to make the film that I wasn't worried about myself. What did happen is after the film came out and premiered in Venice, et cetera, and then started circulating around the world, I think it's been shown in 50 or 55 film festivals, on national TV and in 3 European countries. Proceso, probably the most significant magazine in Mexico, put him on the cover with a freeze frame for the movie, and that's when he disappeared. I mean, then things got real hot for him, and God knows where he is, but the footsteps got very close after that.
You think you'll ever talk to him again?
I don't know. I hope not, because I want him far away. I don't want to be around when he's murdered. Well, I'll just say,
I mean, you think that's...
I grew to like the guy, you know. I knew him pretty well. I don't want to stand over his corpse. I could certainly understand the demand for vengeance from, Jesus, the hundreds, possibly thousands of people that were affected by his crimes. But I don't want to be around when he's killed, and he's going to be killed. Mathematically, he only gets one mistake, and then they kill him.
That is something that comes across in the film, is the inevitability of how this is going to end. There seems to be no doubt in his mind, and it sounds like in your mind as well, that he's not going to die an old man.
I don't think so. I don't see how he makes it. I think he'd be dead now except for the explosion of violence in Mexico. I think their to-do list got very long in the Juarez Drug Organization. Well, they'll get around to him eventually. He told me something once. I said, do these contracts ever expire? And we were driving around, and he tapped the windshields where they engrave your vehicle number, your chassis number. And he said, it's just like that number. It never goes away.
You mentioned that it's been to a lot of film festivals, but they've all been in Europe, and we are...
That's been persona non grata here.
Yeah.
They're rejected by every major film festival in the United States, categorically.
Why do you think that is?
It's an unspeakable thing. Well, I think several things. One, it's got Christian redemption. Two, it isn't a progressive film. This is how Mexico operates now and how it's operated for decades, and it's a pretty sad story. The Sicario was not a rogue cop. That's a lie. The Sicario was not some sort of deviant. When you watch this movie, you're looking at the face of the Mexican government. It's the same face it's had for decades, and that's not a popular way to look at things.
Charles Bowden published more than 20 books in his lifetime, many about the Southwest, and he had a particular interest in the violence and poverty gripping Juarez, Mexico. And to anyone who came across his work, he'll be remembered as a prophet, bringing uncomfortable insights about the region and culture we inhabit. Charles Bowden died on August 30th of this year at his home in Las Cruces, New Mexico, at the age of 69. The preceding was a discussion of his 2011 film, El Sicario, Room 164, which Bowden co-produced with Gianfranco Rossi. On Film's producer is Norma Martinez. I'm Charles Horak. Thank you for listening to On Film.